Now, forecast details from the National Weather Service for Friday the 11th. Sunny for the morning, then partly sunny and very warm for the afternoon, heading for a high of 83. Tonight, sunset will be quarter after 6. Cloudy and cool, a low of 53. Here's the weekend. Saturday, partly sunny and 66. Sunday, partly sunny, 30% chance of rain. Sunday's high 62. This morning, wind is from the south at 6. Sunshine and 58 degrees in both Kenosha and Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. For part one of today's program, we're going to be talking about something that is going to be occurring on the stage of the Racine Theater Guild tomorrow night. It is a performance by Stepping Stone Theater, and it's going to be a night of comic improv. And one of the mainstays of this will be the founder of Stepping Stone Theater, Julia Morales, who is a Second City Main Stage alumni. And of course, a lot of us who follow the world of comedy are very, very well acquainted with Second City and the extraordinary wealth of talent that they have represented over the years. And we're going to talk for the next few minutes with Julia Morales about kind of the whole nature of improv on stage and what makes it challenging, what it means to study improv, and the excitement that it gives her and her colleagues. And maybe we'll get a little sense of what one can perhaps expect tomorrow night at the Racine Theater Guild. Again, the Stepping Stone Theater improv performance is going to be tomorrow night at the Racine Theater Guild. And Julia Morales, we welcome you to the morning show.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for having me.
I am very, very excited that you are with us today. Thank you for making time for this conversation. Tell us, first of
all,
it's a real basic question, but I think it's a great place to start. Tell us what sort of the world of performing has been for you over the years, and then at what point this thing called improv started to be more central to your theatrical endeavors, shall we say.
Oh wow! I went to acting school. I went to two of them, and so I've been doing acting for a very long time. I went to the American Musical Dramatic Academy, and I also went to the University of Houston School of Theater and Dance. And so, improv was not exactly something that was on my radar immediately. I got a scholarship to take the classes at a theater in New York for improv. And that was through NBC. And so I ended up moving from Houston to New York. And I studied comedy there. And I really, truly fell in love with it. I fell in love with improv mostly because, you know, you can be whatever you want. You can have so much fun. It's a bunch of adults playing make-believe. I felt like it was very therapeutic. And it was something that really just brought me joy on a daily basis. I've always wanted to share that same joy with other people, so I've gotten more invested with programming and helping out other people and kind of using my story, which is kind of a whirlwind, because I've kind of been all over the place trying to figure out what I want to do with this, because to be honest, you can't get paid to really do improv. That's not like a regular job that you can have on a regular basis, but there are ways to utilize this talent and this skill to put it into other foundations and have just as much fun, enjoy, and obviously make a little bit of money from it.
Sure.
So I found myself auditioning for a Second City ship back in October, well, back in 2013. And I got on my first Second City ship. And I'm sure most people are not familiar with that. Second City was on Norwegian cruise lines for some time. And we had shows out on the seas. And that was really fun. So I did about 5 of those contracts. And I was in New York. I was living in New York at the time. And I just fell in love with Chicago. And I said, you know what, I think I'm just going to move here and plant some roots here and see what this is like. And probably one of the best decisions I've ever made. I love the city, and I love putting the work into the community here.
Hmm. In all that you just said about your life and kind of your pathway to where you are now in the world of entertainment, what jumped out at me almost more than anything was when you made mention, almost rather matter-of-factly, of studying comedy and studying comic improv. And it's just kind of an interesting notion to think about when one studies comedy, what does that look like? I mean, what kinds of things are you learning about? I mean, you know, at a glance, it seems like what you'd be learning about is like what's funny or how to be funny.
Right.
But of course,
right.
I'm sure studying comedy involves a whole lot more than that.
Well, there's so many different aspects to comedy, right? You know, you have the writing portion, the acting portion, and then you break it down to improv, sketch, stand-up, solo material. There's a variety of things within this beautiful art form. And I kind of clinged on to improv at first, mostly because I get to enrich my skills and make my brain work hard to see how many different ways can I play different characters, play with my voice, stretch my range. So when you're studying comedy, more so just the foundation of what improv comedy is, which most people know as yes and, but what makes one show more entertaining than the other is the part that you're kind of studying. You're learning how to be patient on stage, making offers to your scene partners, supporting your scene partners, moving the scenes forward, bringing callbacks, paying attention. Those are all elements that are broken down in classes to make us stronger improvisers so that we can have really fun shows.
Hmm.
So that is the big part of studying improv or studying comedy. And then, of course, there's parts of comedy where you study the history of comedy. From all over the world. There's a history behind it, which I still find myself still learning and diving into. I'm always learning something new. And then you have some, you know, so many people who have been so successful in this field. So you're learning about them and learning about their perspective and their philosophy behind comedy. It is a subjective art form. So, you know, different things appeal to different people, which to me is so much fun because, you know, toilet humor might be funny for some people, but very heady, intelligent humor might be different for other people. People like physicality, some people might not. Some people like dry humor and some people don't. So it's nice to see the many ways that people come up with their version of comedy.
Do you see most people who are really good at improv as having some particular gift for improv? I mean, I think a lot of us assume that being good at that, and it's something that, you know, is one of those kind of amazing talents that those of us who don't possess it, you know, sort of marvel at. But does it typically spring from a real natural gift, a natural facility? Or is there a component that is also learned?
You know, I think the gift is the desire to learn. I think that's the gift, the desire to be fearless and to learn. Because, yes, there are people who are naturally funny. And, you know, I come from a family. We all laugh and we joke. And we've been like that, you know, since I was a kid. But and maybe some people are fans of comedy and want to kind of dip their toes into it. It may not have come from that environment. But I believe truly that we all are naturally funny in various ways. It's about whether or not you choose to step into the world of comedy and take that first class and to see what it feels like to play a couple of games with a group of people and not self-judge. Don't judge yourself. Don't judge other people. Just go in there, have fun, be silly, laugh, and then see where it goes from there. People normally gravitate towards different aspects of comedy, so especially improv. And so I truly believe that if you just have the desire to follow that fear, I think fear keeps a lot of people away from it, saying, oh, no, I can't do that. No, I'm not that funny. No, it's a lot of self-deprecating. Of, you know, if you let that go and have fun, you can learn a lot more. You can be a little bit more free and a little bit more silly. And trust me, you will be very good at this art form.
Hmm. We're speaking with Julia Morales, and she's going to be one of the headliners for a performance that will be taking place tomorrow night at the Racine Theater Guild, a night of improv courtesy of the Stepping Stone Theater, which Julia Morales founded. If I am reading correctly, you founded Stepping Stone Theater to celebrate diversity within the comedy community. Tell us more about that and about the kind of diversity that we are talking about that this group sort of lifts up and celebrates.
Yeah, so we have so many comedic voices and coming into different places where you did not see a lot of different you know, colors and different sorts of folks in on the stages. And it's been something like that for quite some time. Over the years, the stages have become very diverse. But with that, in continuing that celebration, I wanted to create a platform for marginalized voices to have opportunities to learn and grow, and also just be guided into places that they feel comfortable going to, and just being supportive of the things that other people want to do as performers. So Stepping Stone came out of the pandemic with the initiative of wanting to help those, as many people as possible. So with that, we included the 10,000 Hours program, which is a program that I created back in 2011 when I was living in New York. And the 10,000 Hours program is basically, it is improvisers who are getting 2 hours of playtime with a volunteer coach. So it's not a class. There's nothing there that you're going to, quote unquote, learn, or there's no agenda or curriculum. It is someone there to guide you through some fun games and exercises, and then you just get to play and practice. And, we're going with the idea of, course, 10,000 hours, eventually, if you put in 10,000 hours, you become an expert in your field. So giving people those opportunities to learn and grow. So that has been a big part of our programming lately. We have put up some shows here and there. We're still working around how we want to facilitate, how we work in our community. And it's been really nice. We've had a lot of support from Second City, Annoyance, I.O., Logan Square Improv, the Corn Servitory, and several other theaters in the community. So this has been really nice. And, we're open to all sorts of things. And again, programming is our number one thing that we do at Stepping Stone.
By the way, it's kind of interesting to think about how when we think about improv, we almost always think about it in terms of comedy. And we don't think very often about improv within the realm of drama. I'm curious, first of all, maybe there's improv drama that I'm just not aware of, but if there is such a thing, I don't know that I've ever heard of it. And I just wonder in what way you think the wedding of improv with comedy makes more sense than improv with drama.
Well, there are actually quite a few troops out there in the in the country who do improv drama, and I've seen some of it myself. It's pretty fun to watch. They normally follow some sort of narrative. I've seen very experimental improv that is not comedy. Improv naturally is comedic. So I think that, with that being said, it's more about the execution, how it's delivered. And a lot of times improv is used as a tool to help write, whether it's a sketch or a play or a short story of some kind. It does drive us to create more and see what do our performers come up with so that we can, write this out later on.
So we want to make sure people know about two facets of what's happening. First of all, the free improv workshop that people can experience at 5 o'clock, and one can sign up for that via the Racine Theater Guild website, racinetheater.org. And then, of course, your performance for the public at 7:30 on the stage of the Racine Theater Guild. It seems in some ways counterintuitive to ask what people can expect a Saturday night, because, of course, part of the whole point of improv is that it's not scripted, not strictly laid out, and who knows what exactly is going to happen. But can you give us at least a general sense of what is likely to happen Saturday evening?
Of course. So as far as the workshop goes, it will be very fun. It'll be loose. It'll be we're going to introduce the world of improv to people at the bare minimum level. That way people can kind of get a taste for what this is like and eventually see if it's something that they want to do on their own. So there will be a lot of games, a lot of laughing, a lot of silliness. So I highly recommend that people come by. I will be leading that workshop. Very excited to meet folks out there. And as far as the show goes, we're going to do some long-form improv. We're going to introduce you to short-form improv. And we're also going to throw in some magic.
Wow.
Mhm. Yeah. I'll keep it minimal because I don't want to spoil anything. But I will say there will be some magic. We're very excited about it.
Wow. Very, very good. So, when you get done with a night of comic improv, typically, what do you feel like? I mean, is it a draining experience or an energizing experience or a little bit of both? And typically when you look back, are you kind of dissecting what happened and wishing certain things had gone better, or is a life of improv about, kind of rising above that and just letting it be what it's ever going to be?
That's a great question. Honestly, I'm a vet. I've been doing improv for almost 20 years now. But I'll tell you the various things that I know people go through. Most people, like myself, are very excited. If it's a fun show, the energy is up. You're excited. You're talking to your castmates of all the funny things that happened, and showing each other love and praise for what they did on the stage. And most times people, we go to the bar, have a drink type of thing, and just like really absorb, marinate in that moment of excitement and being proud of the show. On the other hand, I've been, I've had shows where it's like, ooh, that was rough. But we talk about it. Most times people will talk about it and dissect it. Of course, every actor, we want to do a really great show. We want things to be as perfect as possible. And so, yes, it will sit with us. depending on the stakes of the show. If it's a low-stakes show, we normally just shake it off and say, all right, we'll try again tomorrow. But oftentimes, you know, we can be hard on ourselves as performers. So I do work very diligently to make sure people take it easy. I don't want to say the typical, it's just a game type of attitude. But it's more so, hey, we got more shows coming up. Let's just do better. So it varies from person to person. But honestly, a majority of those feelings have been excitement and laughter. Even if it's the most bizarre show, you laugh at the fun, bizarre things because you're with your friends. You're with people that you enjoy being around. And you get to sit there and poke fun at each other and be silly, which is always really nice. What a great end to the evening.
Julia Morales, an alum of Second City Main Stage, brings her Stepping Stone Theater troupe for a night of comic improv at the Racine Theater Guild. That performance is at 7:30, and there is a free improv workshop that's going to be taking place at 5 p.m. And more information on both of these events and ticket information also is available at the website of the Racine Theater Guild. That's racinetheater.org. And you can also, of course, call the box office at 262-633-4218. Julie Morales, thank you so much for being my morning show guest today. It was wonderful to talk with you. Best wishes to you and Stepping Stone Theater. And thank you again.
Thank you so much for having me.
You are listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg, and now an interview that comes from The Morning Show Archive. I'm going to be speaking for the next few minutes on WGTD's Morning Show with David C. Taylor, who is the author of a wonderful new novel called Nightlife, which takes us into the heart of New York City over a half century ago, when New York City was in many respects a very, very different place, a sometimes incredibly dangerous place. It was also in its own way gripped by the Red Scare of the McCarthy era. And David C. Taylor is someone who wrote for decades for both television and the movies. He has also directed his talents towards short stories and even the production of an off-Broadway musical. In some respects, several of his the strands of past lives and past efforts come together really beautifully in this wonderfully crafted thriller novel, which is published by Forge. David C. Taylor, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thank you very much. After listening to that, I'm going to go read the book.
Ah, well, that's part of the idea. Ahead of us talking about the novel, maybe you could fill in some of the specifics of what I just sketched out in terms of the wide-ranging career that you have had, and particularly the many years that you spent writing for television and movies. What kind of things have you done, and would they suggest a novel like Nightlife was in your future?
Well, I actually started off writing short stories and realized I was going to starve to death, and went to Los Angeles with the idea that I'd be there for a year or two to make a little bit of money and go back to writing short stories, and I stayed for 22 years. Writing for television is probably, which is what I started doing, writing for television is good training about structure, and it's good training about concision. You're always limited by the amount of time that the show will have. Something like The Rockford Files was an hour show, which gave you 48 minutes, which was condensed to about 39 or 40 pages of script, and you had to tell the story very quickly. The joy of writing prose fiction, going back to the novel, is that you are allowed to breathe a little bit more, but the idea of structure and having things begin at the beginning of the story and pay off further down the line is all the training that I got writing for movies and television.
Very good. And for the most part, you were writing things like the Rockford Files, I mean, sort of cop shows or crime dramas, that kind of thing?
Well, I started off that way, and then I sold a couple of feature films, which got me out of television for a while, for a long while, and I went back to doing television movies sort of towards the end of my time in Los Angeles. So I did do some cop shows early on, and one of the movies I wrote with Tom Selleck was about a thief in London in 1939. So that's kind of a cop show, too. I've always been interested in those propulsive stories that pull you along quickly. And, of course, police dramas, thrillers, whatever you want to call them, allow you to do that. I guess part of that is I'm an impatient man, so I like to be pulled through the story quickly.
Your biography says that you spend at least some of your time in Maine. I'm always kind of intrigued by the notion of somebody spending most of their time in an idyllic place like Maine, surrounded by gorgeous scenery, probably a very idyllic setting in many respects, writing a hard-hitting, gritty crime drama like Nightlife.
Yeah, Maine was always part of my life. I had my first birthday in Maine. My father was a writer. He wrote Vertigo for Alfred Hitchcock, but he was primarily a playwright in New York, and we would leave New York City a day or two after my brother and I got out of school, and we wouldn't come back until, because my father didn't have to be here, we wouldn't come back until the beginning of September when we had to go back to school. So that Maine life was a continuum through my childhood and my adolescence, and we did the same thing to our children. My wife and I did. We would fly from California to Maine and spend the summers there. And it's a wonderful place to write. And since you're living in your own head anyway when you're writing stories, it doesn't really matter where you are. You don't have to be in New York City to write about New York City. And Maine presents you with so much calm that you can get up in the morning and work for 3 or 4 or 5 hours, and then you have the rest of the day to do other things.
Mm. As we've already touched on, your novel Nightlife is set in New York City, but not current New York City, but rather New York City of the 1950s. And you write about it so vividly, as though you walked the streets of New York City back in the days of the McCarthy hearings. Tell us about sort of the challenge of evoking this relatively distant past in the history of New York City.
Well, I did grow up in New York City, and New York was essentially unchanged up until the early part of the 60s. And 1954, I was 10, but my brother and I, like a great many people in New York, young people, there wasn't as much scrutiny, parental scrutiny, as you might get now, and we were kind of free-range children in a way. We were out on the streets, not in any dangerous way. There were sort of three precepts when you were growing up in New York in those times. Stay out of Central Park at night. Don't make too much eye contact on the streets, and don't speak to strangers. And after that, that was it, you know. Oh, and look both ways before you cross the street. And we would tell our parents when I was about 11, my brother was 13, that we were going to the local theater to watch a double feature, which gave us 4 hours of free time. And then we'd head for Times Square and the pinball arcades and, you know, the kind of interesting places you could go and grab a sandwich. And finally, we discovered pool halls. We used to play pool in a place called McGurr's on 8th Avenue in the 50s, where it was in a basement. And when you went down there, you were breathing secondhand smoke that had been exhaled in 1934. Mm. And so we were... The vividness of Times Square at that time is very strong in my mind. When I set to write Nightlife, I, of course, didn't want to write about a 10-year-old. I wanted to write about a man. So what I did was I brought the memories of my time on the streets in New York, running around all the way up through my teens, to this story. But it wasn't hard to remember what it was like. And then, of course, now you can go look at so many images of that time that it would really bring the memories back in a very strong way.
As you evoke that era of older New York City. I wonder what the proportion is of affectionate nostalgia versus probably relief that some of the darker aspects of that era are now gone. And I'm not even speaking so much about the McCarthy stuff, which is an important theme in your novel, but just, I mean, there are certain people who actually miss that New York City for as much as there was more crime and perhaps more corruption and other things, but feel like the place was more real, more authentic than kind of the glitzy, showbizzy place that it is now. What are your own feelings about New York City of that era, and how do you think that colored the way you portrayed it in your novel?
Well, I think we all look back on our history with sort of nostalgia and an unclear view. New York then, I love New York then. It was very different than it is now. You know, New York, like many cities, has become sort of a place of the chains and the sort of homogenized aspects that you get through all the big cities in America. But New York then was a series of villages. When you went down to Greenwich Village then, it was completely different from the Upper East Side. It no longer is, except physically. Now, when you're in Greenwich Village, it's no longer bohemia. Now it's, blonde women pushing two children in $1,000 baby carriages. So that's very different. Soho was an industrial part of the city then. Tribeca, well, there was no such thing as Tribeca. Tribeca was printing plants and stuff like that. So all that has changed. And in changing, the city has lost some character. It's still the most exciting city in America, I think. I mean, I come back here. I'm here now. I'm in New York right now, and I love it. I get out on the street, and the energy changes, and I begin. I suspect I throw off some of who I am now and become some of who I was then. You move faster on the streets, and you walk a lot, and I don't know. New York is different, but New York is still New York.
We're speaking with David C. Taylor, and we're talking about his novel, which is called Nightlife, set in New York City back in the 1950s. Your main character is a policeman by the name of Michael Cassidy, and you've painted him as a complex man with a complex background and an interesting kind of, let's call it, a personal quirk that we'll talk about in just a moment. Talk for a moment about what a main protagonist in a novel like this needs to be in general, and then specifically how you aligned yourself with that in creating the character of Michael Cassidy more specifically.
Well, of course, you want a compelling protagonist. Now, how do you make a compelling protagonist? You can't make him completely simple. Superman is a compelling protagonist in some ways, but he becomes more interesting because kryptonite can affect his superpowers. So when you're dealing with a human being like Michael Cassidy, you want to make him capable of heroism, but also capable of mistakes and of irrationality and of anger and all the things that we have in ourselves that make him recognizable. At the same time, you want to give him a heroic aspect of some sort. Michael Cassidy, when somebody asks him why he's a cop, essentially it comes down to he hates bullies, which seems very simplistic, but he's not a man who's interested in trying to talk about himself. I mean, after all, in the 50s, the idea that we examined ourselves and spoke about it all the time did not exist. So he's a little bit of one of those men who's a little bit more quiet than we're used to now. And but when he says that he hates bullies, it opens up a whole world of what you can be as a policeman. I mean, after all, there are cops in the story who are bullies. And he doesn't like that much. And so that is a big part of his character.
Right. In fact, one of the most dramatic moments, we won't say too much about it, is where basically he throws a colleague out of a window over this very notion of bullying. The guy is brutally bullying a woman in this instance, and Mike Cassidy is not about to stand by idly and let that happen. But one has a sense, given the force of his response to what he witnesses, that this is among the most important principles guiding who he is and what kind of cop he's going to be.
Yeah, I think that's true. It's interesting in that scene, of course, that he dreamed before he did that he was going to do it. He just didn't know it was going to be like that.
Mm-hmm. Where did you get that notion of this cop who's otherwise in so many ways down to earth, well grounded, but has this ability, evidently, of dreaming of certain events before they actually occur, something that he himself doesn't understand and is very reluctant to share with anybody. How did you come up with that intriguing idea?
I had dreams like that as a kid.
Oh.
Never quite so specific as what he dreams, but I had dreams that were not, I mean, you know, we all know what deja vu is, where we think we have seen something before, and there are lots of explanations for that. But it turns out, in doing a little research, I it's always intrigued me that I had these dreams as a boy. Actually, they lasted until I was in my 20s. Very rare, but occasionally I would absolutely know, I would remember dreaming this incident, and the incident would now be before me. So I did a little bit of research, and it turns out there are quite a number of people who have sort of, it's hard to say that they're precognitive dreams, but they are dreams that in some ways do come true. And then I read that there was a society in somewhere out in the South Pacific that actually controls their dreams so that they can go back into them the next night, and their dreams become like their novels. And I do remember when I was quite young, I mean, you know, 10, 11, 12, whatever that was, that I would have dreams the next night that I could go back into briefly. Hmm. Briefly, I would be able to. So I did a little research about it, and I thought, well, you know, it's an interesting quirk, and it's a useful part of storytelling. If a man has dreams that he doesn't know what the hell they're about, and some of them come true and some of them don't, and he doesn't know which ones are going to come true and which ones are just go wherever dreams go.
One of the most intriguing relationships in the book is between Michael Cassidy and his father, who is a well-known, popular figure in the world of Broadway, in the world of theater. And he is someone who, in some respects, is not a particularly admirable figure. I mean, as a father or husband, certainly.
Right.
And yet somehow you paint him in a way that leaves us kind of understanding him, if we're not maybe exactly sympathetic to him. Talk a little bit about this particular character and the care with which you constructed him.
Well, you know, so many people in American life are immigrants, and Tom Cassidy, who changed his name from Kasnovetsky, gets out of sort of the Russian-Polish border in about before World War I, when the Tsar was still alive, because he didn't want to be conscripted into the Tsar's armies, because too many people died doing that. So this was a kid who didn't have much family left and had a bleak future, and like many American stories, had the courage to try and get the hell out and come to the States. And he eventually does, arriving as about a 15-year-old, and discovers that the streets of New York are not actually paved with gold. But he he's a fighter and a scrambler, and he ends up making friends with guys on the Lower East Side of New York who turn out to have names like Luciano and Costello, and are eventually going to grow up to be some of the big-time gangsters in New York's history. And it turns out that Frank Costello, who was a kid with Tom Cassidy on the Lower East Side, eventually becomes Michael Cassidy, the cop's godfather, which and Tom Cassidy is a survivor, so he He was involved with bootlegging during Prohibition, but when he got the money that he needed, he got out of that and became a legitimate producer on Broadway. I mean, Broadway is an interesting environment anyway, you know, and there are not a lot of really strict rules, especially back then, about how one became a producer and what that entailed. There were a lot of people who cut corners and did things that were necessary to survive, and I think Tom Cassidy is one of those guys. But he's in love with the American dream. He believes in the American dream greatly, really greatly. And he marries a woman who comes from a family that probably helped tie up the Mayflower. And that disparity of understanding about what life is all about makes for a complicated relationship, and he has a complicated relationship with his children because he can't believe that they aren't automatically happy since he has provided all the things he never had as a child. I think that's a very American story.
This is a passage from the book that I especially love. You write this: his father's world was the theater, a business that kept him out late, caused him to travel, involved him, as Cassidy had learned, with other women who offered him something his wife did not. He expected to come home to a perfect American household, a loving wife and three happy, handsome, bright children, the house neat and clean, the laundry done, dinner on the table, whenever he chose to appear. When he left in the morning, it was as if in his mind the family remained behind, unchanging, locked in amber until his return. It was not, Cassidy eventually understood, malice or indifference on his father's part. It was just an inability to consider what happened outside his immediate orbit. He had come from so little and had gained so much, had come so far and was so happy with where he had arrived, that he could not believe that anyone who had not had that struggle could be unhappy. He was an instinctive optimist, and if he was happy, everyone was happy. How could it be otherwise? He viewed the world through the crack in his own forehead and assumed that everyone saw what he saw.
We all do that, don't we?
I think to some extent we do, even if we don't live out our lives with the specifics that that he did. But
yeah.
But yeah, I think that's a very, very common phenomenon.
Yeah. Yeah, I have no idea really where Tom Cassidy came from in my head. There's nothing autobiographical about it. It's certainly not the relationship I had with my own father, who was a Broadway writer for the most part. Was very involved in the theater, and that was a big part of our lives then. But I don't know where it came from. I mean, I think when you begin writing novels at my age, there's so much experience and so many people living inside you that people surface who you have no idea of their antecedents. And you can grab a hold of one and just see where he'll take you.
Right. I really appreciate the fact that this world sort of pokes its nose into the midst of this crime drama, because for all the novels that I have read that are kind of in this grimy, gritty urban setting, almost never has this sort of world of the theater been any kind of significant element, even though, of course, that's a big part of what New York City is.
Yeah, especially around, you know, then around Broadway. I mean, in the Broadway that I grew up with, there were probably 40 new plays every year, you know? It was a really vibrant. I mean, you could succeed and fail. It didn't matter. You could put on a play that lasted 3 weeks, and then, you know, you could come back later in the year and put on a play that lasted 3 years. That's very changed because Broadway's become so expensive now to produce a play. I mean, musicals are $12-15 million productions.
Right. So at least one of the central events in your novel is the murder following brutal torture of a man who turns out to be an actor in a production in town. And the mystery is who would want to murder him, who would want to brutalize him, what were they after? Tell us more about this element of the story.
Well, you know, Alfred Hitchcock, who was, after all, a master of the mystery, used to talk about the MacGuffin. And the MacGuffin was whatever it is that everybody in the story is pursuing. And he used to say it doesn't matter whether it has real intrinsic value as long as everybody in the story believes that it has great value. So the MacGuffin in this particular story are photographs, but we don't really know what the photographs are of. We just know that this dead Broadway gypsy, Broadway dancer, had some, and that there are a great many people who seem to want them. The mob wants them for reasons we don't understand. Everybody talks about these photographs as leverage. So Frank Costello, who is a gangster and who is Michael Cassidy's godfather, wants them. The FBI and the CIA in the 50s were having a turf war because it still wasn't really decided which of those two organizations would control the intelligence operations. The J. Edgar Hoover wanted the CIA to simply disappear because he thought that the FBI should be given control of both foreign intelligence and national intelligence. And at the same time, the CIA, which really only was born in about 1949, was trying hard to become the primary intelligence agency. So they both those are fighting each other to try and get the same photographs, though we don't know why. And eventually, as in any good novel, everything becomes clear.
Hmm. And of course, that is one of the most interesting dynamics to this story, and it's something we've seen before, but I think you depict it very well, that rub of competition between, in a sense, competing law enforcement entities and in some cases holding their own information close to their vest, sort of barging in, making themselves at home, sort of taking over. That is a reality that, of course, plays out all the time in the real world right to this day.
Yeah, we see it, you know, the turf wars between the FBI and Homeland Security and all those people who don't seem to share information until it is revealed that they didn't share information. You know, they're all trying to be, in some ways, the primary enforcement. I think it's very human, of course, because everybody is in competition still. Hmm. We're not that far from the trees.
Right. And I think it's, I think you also do a really good job of portraying basically all of the cops in this story as very realistic, and the vast majority of them far from pristine characters.
Yeah.
In a couple of cases, you talk about someone who started out very much kind of an idealist, a purist, but they've just had that kind of punched and pummeled out of them over the course of the years of doing this hard work.
Yeah, I think that being a cop in a big city must really grind you down. You spend so much time dealing with the worst elements of human society in small, brutal ways. I mean, you know, there's just that daily brutality that happens on city streets. You don't get to spend a lot of time with people who are dreamers and artists and people who look on the bright side. You're mostly dealing with people who look on the dark side, and I think it must be very, very hard on your soul after a while.
Mm. Well, it's a marvelously crafted novel. Again, it's called Nightlife, and it is published by Forge, and the author, David C. Taylor. David C. Taylor, I've really enjoyed speaking with you, as I enjoyed reading your novel, and hope that there'll be many more novels coming from your pen in the years to come. And I appreciate you joining me.
Mm-hmm. The next one's out April 1st of next year.
Wow, very good.
Yep.
We wish you well with all of your future writing, and I thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show.
Thank you very much, Greg.
It's a minute before 9 o'clock here on WGTD. Tomorrow, in the podcast version of The Morning Show from The Morning Show Archives, Bill Guy, my predecessor as host of The Morning Show, in a conversation recorded with the legendary Augie Schmidt, longtime baseball coach at Carthage, who recently announced his retirement. Look for The Morning Show with Greg Berg to enjoy the podcast version of The Morning Show. On Monday, the Kenosha Community Foundation joins us. Today, a mostly sunny sky this morning, although we will have a few clouds rolling in this afternoon, a high today of 83 degrees, much cooler later in the weekend. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha,